Cheers to my fellow sports fans out there. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the USA Today Sports Weekly, bringing us the sports news of the week, which is for the week June 25th through July 1st. Strangely enough, in this week where we had an NBA champion crowned and also an NHL champion, the cover story pictures Manny Machado of the San Diego Padres with the one-word headline, Misunderstood. Well, we'll deal with that odd situation, but start with the leading-off column, which this week is written by Jenny Carlson of the Oklahoman. With Paycom Center rattling and shaking, and the Indiana Pacers finally seeming to do the same, Jalen Williams joined the celebration by closing his eyes, pumping his fists, and adding his voice to the roar. Come on, he bellowed. And Thunder fans did. Let's go, he thundered. The fans did, and the Thunder did. Oklahoma City is the NBA champion. On a night, the Thunder outlasted the Pacers 103-91 in Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Oklahoma City has plenty of reason to celebrate. The title. The triumph. But as much as anything, this was a chance to reach a mountaintop only ever seen before. Oh, the Thunder had climbed the mountain before, but they never reached that summit. Now they stand at the top. It's a group of guys that have an uncommon mentality, an uncommon connection, and competitiveness together, Thunder coach Mark Dagenau said just before the playoffs began. That's where our confidence comes from. If you have a lot of experience, that gives you confidence. But there's other sources of confidence. We're a confidence team because of who we are, how we've operated, and mainly what we have in our locker room. We never knew if we'd see the Thunder return to this point. After all, we saw firsthand how difficult that first ascent was. When I think back to where we started in 2008, we were looking up a pretty steep mountain, General Manager Sam Presti said in September of 22. We didn't have a team name. We had no uniforms. Some would argue we didn't have much of a team at the time. But we climbed the mountain. And did they ever. A year after relocating to Oklahoma City and winning only 23 games, the Thunder made the playoffs, pushed the Lakers to 6 games, made Kobe and company sweat repeatedly, left the Black Mamba passing Kevin Durant in the back hall and proclaiming, I'm glad we're done with you. But the NBA was just getting started dealing with that Thunder bunch. They made the Western Conference Finals 5 of the next 6 seasons, the lone exception coming in 2015 when injuries hit like an EF5 tornado and wiped out stars and reserves alike. But even counting that season, the Thunder averaged 53.5 wins a season during that 6-year stretch. There were big games and great nights and fun that we thought would never end. But of course, it did. Durant bolted west for the Bay in 2016, and even though the Thunder stayed competitive for another 4 seasons, Presti facilitated it, but Russell Westbrook practically willed it into being, they were clearly starting the descent. They didn't have a title contender roster. They were coming down the mountain. We fought it as long as we could, Presti said in 22. We stayed up there for a long time. We had a pretty good run of sustained success, and now we're facing another climb. In the first couple of seasons, the Thunder didn't seem to be getting very far. 22 wins in 2021, and only 24 in 2022. But the next season, the Thunder started gaining altitude. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was an all-star and a first-team All-NBA selection. Williams made a run at Rookie of the Year, and best of all, the Thunder won 40 games and made the play-in tournament. Didn't survive to make the playoffs, but the climb had begun. Presti referenced the second mountain in the end-of-season press conference. We're staring that sucker down, he said. The thing is, the Thunder have not merely looked at the mountain. They have attacked it with the ferocity of a Tasmanian devil. The Thunder won 57 games a year ago and earned the number one seed in the Western Conference, becoming the youngest team to ever claim a top seed. It was such a breakthrough season that it seemed entirely possible that the Thunder could be better this season, but win less games and not win the West. Well, it was better in every way, more wins, more dominance, more accolades too. Gilgeous Alexander won the MVP and tacked on another first-team All-NBA, while Lou Dort was finally named a first-team All-Defense. Jalen Williams, a first-time All-Star, was also a third-team All-NBA and second-team All-Defense. But for the regular season grandeur, the Thunder were only the seventh team in NBA history to win at least 68 games in the regular season, and they had the highest margin of victory in the history of the association, 12.84 points. But for that, none of that was the goal. The title was, and now the Thunder have it. It was a battle to get it, not only the seven games that Indiana pushed Oklahoma City to in the finals, but also the final game. Even after Pacers stands out Tyrese Halliburton went down with an injury in the first half, it was later determined to be an Achilles tear, Indiana pushed. It turned a first quarter deficit into a halftime lead. It kept the Thunder within arm's length for much of the third quarter. But late in the frame, the Thunder paired defensive stops with a flurry of baskets, two from Kayson Wallace, that is, two from Williams, one from Isaiah Hartenstein, and they built a double-digit lead. The lead ballooned to 20-plus in the fourth quarter, and even though the Pacers kept coming, because of course they did, the Thunder had done enough to secure the win, the title, and the trophy. The mountain had been scaled again. But the first time the summit was reached, the view has never been quite like this. Let's stick with the NBA theme for a couple of more stories. This one comes from Jeff Zilgit, a columnist for USA Today. An earthquake that rattled Las Vegas on July 5, 2019, suspended play for the night at NBA Summer League. Hours later, another seismic event altered the direction of the NBA in ways that were not immediately recognized. The Oklahoma City Thunder traded Paul George to the Los Angeles Clippers for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and the focus of the deal was George joining Kawhi Leonard on the Clippers. Gilgeous-Alexander had just finished an encouraging rookie season, and as part of the deal, the Thunder acquired multiple first-round picks, including the Clippers' 2022 pick that turned into All-Star Jalen Williams. 6 years after the Thunder acquired Gilgeous-Alexander, and 3 years after they selected Williams with the number 12 overall pick in the 22 draft, the Thunder are NBA champions, with Gilgeous-Alexander and Williams excelling throughout the regular season, the playoffs, and, of course, the finals. The Thunder defeated the Indiana Pacers 103-91 in Game 7 on June 22nd, putting their historical mark on a season that included 68 regular season victories, 16 playoff victories, and the Thunder's first NBA title since moving to Oklahoma City from Seattle in 2008. Gilgeous-Alexander was named Finals MVP, going for 29 points, 12 assists, 5 rebounds in Game 7, and averaging 30.3 points, 5.6 assists, 4.6 rebounds, and 1.9 steals in the finals. Gilgeous-Alexander is the first player since LeBron James back in 2013 to win a title, regular season MVP, and finals MVP in the same season. Williams, who in each finals game gained more confidence in his ability to score from wherever he wanted, averaged 23.6 points versus the Pacers, and scored 40 in Game 5, with 20 in Game 7. The team was meticulously assembled by Executive Vice President and General Manager Sam Presti. The Thunder feature two All-Stars, talented young players, savvy veterans. They're a team that has offensive and defensive versatility. Presti brought in a then early 30-something and open-minded assistant coach named Mark Dagenau from the Florida Gators men's basketball team to coach Oklahoma City's G League team in 2014. He became the Thunder's head coach in 2020. "I'm just so happy for these guys," he said. "This is an uncommon team. This is a great team. All the boxes that this team checked during the season, it's an historic team. But there's no guarantee you end it the way we did. The way they approach it, the professionalism, the competitiveness, team-first nature, I wanted it so bad for them." Oklahoma City is the second youngest team to win a championship in the past 70 seasons, with an average age of only 25.6 years old. The Thunder were number one defensively and number three defensively during the regular season. That carried over into the playoffs. "We prioritize winning," Gilgeous Alexander said. "We don't prioritize anything else in this game. We want to win, and we want to win on the highest level. That looks like something new every night, every opponent, every arena. That's all we focused on this whole season. No matter if it was Game 1, Game 45, or Game 105, we prioritized winning. Because we did so, we won on the highest level. The most important part is the group that did it. Our togetherness on and off the court and how much fun we have, it made it so much easier. It made it feel like we were just kids playing basketball. It was so fun." This is the vision Presti had when he started to rebuild. Already one of the game's premier executives, he was named the 24-25 NBA Executive of the Year. Presti wanted a team that can compete for a championship season, season after season. Thunder have been building toward this moment for years. In Dejanoe's first season in 2021, the Thunder went 22-50, then 24-58, then 40-42, 57-25, and then 68-14. "There were early flickers," he said. "Even in those years, those early years, there were challenging times. Certainly they looked like challenging years on paper. How it felt every day was not a reflection of our record or where our standing was in the league. You could feel that something was starting to simmer. You could feel that some of the seeds we were planting were going to be flowering at some point. There were very early indications of that, even in those seasons. We were confident, even back then, not necessarily that we'd be in the finals right now. You never know the timing of when things will come together, but we were confident that we were building something special and something that had the ability to sustain. Well, it came together this season. For a group that had not advanced beyond the second round, the Thunder earned their title. They trailed the Denver Nuggets 1-0 in the Western Conference semifinals and needed to win Game 7 to reach the conference finals, where they handled the Minnesota Timberwolves in just five games. Oklahoma City dropped Game 1 to the Pacers and Game 3. It trailed 2-1 in the series and then won the next two games. It fell in Game 6, but won another winner-take-all contest at home. We've gone through a lot of these experiences together. Haven't pretended that we're more experienced than they are. Haven't pretended that we're more experienced than we are. We've tried to lean on the things that we know have made us successful and put us in this position. It helps to lean on Gilgeous Alexander and Williams, two of the league's best young players. Gilgeous Alexander's 72 points through the first two games against the Pacers were the most ever by a player in his first two career finals games. In Game 4, Gilgeous Alexander scored 15 of his 35 points in the final 5 minutes of the fourth quarter, the most points in the final 5 minutes of regulation of an NBA finals game since 1971. In Game 5, he became the first player to have at least 30 points, 10 assists, and 4 blocks in a finals game since blocks became an official stat back in 73-74. It comes down to the moments and who is willing to make willing plays on both ends of the floor, that is, winning plays on both ends of the floor, said Gilgeous Alexander, only 26. "I relish these moments. I love the moments, good or bad. When I was a kid shooting in my driveway, I'd count down the clock for these moments. Now I get to live it." Williams, who's 24, was an all-star and all-NBA selection for the first time in his three-year career. He improved and became more difficult to defend as the series progressed. In Game 5, he had 40 points, 6 rebounds, and 4 assists, the fifth youngest player to score 40 or more points in a finals game. "My biggest thing is just stepping into the moment, success or fail, just kind of living with the results," he said. "I put a lot of work into my game, so I just go out there and play. I just don't want to ever play a game and look back where I wasn't aggressive, afraid to do a move." The Thunder are not a two-man show, and that was by design. Chet Holmgren, Lou Dort, Isaiah Hartenstein, Alex Caruso, Kayson Wallace, Aaron Wiggins, Kenrich Williams, and Isaiah Joe provided the Thunder with what Dejanoe called optionality. In Game 2, Gilgeous Alexander, Caruso, Williams, Wiggins, and Holmgren became the first set of five teammates since the 2019 Raptors to score at least 15 points each in a finals game. Caruso, in Game 4, was the first to record at least 20 points and 5 steals in a finals game since steals became an official stat. Time and again, the Thunder had a player deliver when necessary. If you followed our team throughout the season, I think you know that flexibility and adaptability is the only constant, Dagenau said. We think that's the strength of our team. And the Thunder should be championship contenders for the next several seasons. Yes, there hasn't been a repeat champion since Golden State did it in 2017 and 2018. That's 7 different championships in 7 seasons. But the Thunder can have the same roster back next season. And with savvy financial planning, they can keep Gilgeous Alexander, Williams, Holmgren, Caruso, Wiggins, and Wallace through at least the 27-28 season, and possibly for a few seasons after that. Plus, they have a stockpile of first-round draft picks available for roster improvements. It is difficult to build a dynasty in today's NBA. Roster restrictions and financial penalties limit what teams can do. Surveying the landscape, the Thunder are in a position to make it happen. I haven't even thought that far ahead, Gilgeous Alexander said. But yeah, we definitely still have room to grow. That's the fun part of this. So many of us can still get better. There's not very many of us on this team that are in our prime or even close to it. We have a lot to grow, individually and as a group. I'm excited for the future of this team. This is a great start, for sure. Couldn't have imagined it any other way. And now we'll shift to a story on the Pacers. The author, Lorenzo Reyes, at least via the headline, asks, is the title window closing on the Pacers? For the second consecutive season, the Indiana Pacers exceeded external expectations and pressed deep into the NBA playoffs. But also, for the second consecutive season, they fell short of their objective of winning the Larry O'Brien Trophy. And in each case, the Pacers were eliminated by the eventual NBA champions. The most difficult part for the Pacers is that, with star point guard Tyrese Haliburton going down early in Game 7 of the Finals with an Achilles injury, Indiana never got its chance to finally put its best foot forward. Now, it must ponder the what-ifs. The Oklahoma City Thunder dispatched Indiana on June 22, 103-91, a year after the Pacers made a surprising run to the Eastern Conference Finals. Behind the clutch play of Haliburton, the steady offensive production of forward Pascal Siakam, and overall team buy-in that saw drastic improvements on defense, the Pacers proved that they can be a formidable force, confounding and frustrating some of the NBA's best team. But can this roster, as currently constructed, with Haliburton now potentially sidelined deep into next season, win an NBA Finals? No moral victories, obviously, Pacers backup point guard T.J. McConnell said after the game. Deflated, but proud of everything we've accomplished. There's no award for second place, obviously, so everyone is upset. Both last year against the Celtics and this season against the Thunder, the Pacers met opponents who had just a little bit more. More consistent star power, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, then Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Jalen Williams. More effective defenses, more versatility that you need to win. Indiana couldn't be the only good team to ultimately miss out on its championship window. Utah Jazz made the playoffs 20 consecutive seasons from 84 to 2003. In a 7-year stretch from 92 to 98, they reached the Western Conference Finals 5 times and made consecutive trips to the NBA Finals in 97 and 98, but they didn't win a title. The Phoenix Suns earned 13 consecutive postseason berths from 89 through 2001, and they made the finals in only 93, but lost. The Seattle Supersonics, who later became Thunder, under George Karl, also come to mind. They lost in the championship round in 1996. Each ran into Michael Jordan. And though number 23 has been retired since 2003, the young Thunder are set to contend for multiple titles. I told these guys coming into this that there's no feel-good scenario when you get to the finals and are unable to get it done, Pacers coach Rick Carlisle said. The Pacers do have a formula that works. They sprint out in transition and are so well conditioned that they can full-court press on defense. With their tempo, they can exhaust opponents and be a nightmare to defend. But Haliburton is the team's engine. He's the one who dictates the tempo at which the Pacers play. Without him, Indiana struggles to create open looks. Just look at the third and fourth quarters in Game 7 as proof when the ball stagnated and McConnell was the only source on offense. If Haliburton does indeed miss most of the next season, Coach Carlisle will need to get creative to help the Pacers keep afloat until he's able to return, if he's able to return at all next year. Unquestionably, McConnell and backup guard Benedict Mathurin will need to step up. But realistically, even when Haliburton is healthy, the team often needed more consistent scoring from him. He's one of the game's premier distributors, but a player who often defers too much to his teammates. Siakam is a star player. Guard Andrew Nembhard and forward Aaron Nesmith are steady, rotation role players. Mathurin can often ignite off the bench, though he is susceptible to error-prone play on occasion. Center Miles Turner, a key presence at both ends, is set to become an unrestricted free agent. Indiana, whether it's Turner or not, needs to find a solution at the five spot. Regardless, the Pacers might still be a piece or two away. Perhaps they can bypass that if Mathurin, who turned 23 on June 19th, continues to develop and embraces efficiency. Regardless, these two deep playoff runs have proved that the Pacers are lacking, though, to be clear, it's not by much. As the players from so many good but not great teams before them can attest, championship windows typically close as quickly as they spring up, said Siakam after the game. I told everyone, I love every single one of these guys and wouldn't do it with anybody else. I'm super proud. So proud of the team. But you know, it's hard to look forward into the future after you lose like this. All right, now let's give the editor his due and read a little bit about Manny Machado. You don't have to like him. You can even hate him. San Diego Padres third baseman Manny Machado really doesn't care. Simply, he doesn't play this game to make friends. He plays this game to beat you. And if you don't respect him for that, hey, it's your loss. Machado, at 32, one of the fiercest competitors in all of baseball, is about to go where only 11 men in history have gone before. He will be the 12th player to produce 2,000 hits with 350 homers before turning 33 years old. Machado, who had 1,989 hits and 354 homers at press time, is on the verge of joining Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Lou Gehrig, Frank Robinson, Mickey Mantle, Jimmy Fox, Mel Ott, Ken Griffey Jr., Albert Pujols, Miguel Cabrera, and Alex Rodriguez as the only men to accomplish the feat. Eight of these players are enshrined in the Hall of Fame, and two have yet to be eligible but are shoe-ins. Those are Pujols and Cabrera. Shh, don't tell anyone, but Machado would love to be part of that distinguished group in Cooperstown one day. I looked up to A-Rod, I looked up to Bonds, I looked up to Albert, Machado tells USA Today Sports. They are all the guys I played the game for. Obviously, there's other pretty special people, but those were the main guys that inspired my game. Those were the guys who played the game elite. We wanted to be those guys. I wanted to be A-Rod, obviously, because I was a shortstop. I wanted to have Albert's swing. I wanted to have the power that Barry Bonds had, hitting it into the water and breaking records that were never meant to be broken. So when people talk about that list, it's pretty special. Machado, who has played shortstop in 236 games, and none since 2019, wants to be remembered as one of the greatest third basemen to ever play the game. After six All-Star appearances, two Gold Gloves, and a Platinum Glove, he's still playing the position better than anyone in the game other than Jose Ramirez of the Cleveland Guardians. There are only 8 third basemen in history who have hit more home runs. He's the only active player to hit at least 28 home runs in 9 consecutive full seasons. And he's showing no signs of a drop-off, leading the National League third baseman in a number of offensive categories, hitting .305 with an .865 OPS to go along with 12 homers and 46 RBI. What the Padres and peers admire the most about Machado is that he consistently posts. He plays every day. No matter how he feels, how much he may be hurting, he's in the lineup. He hasn't missed a game this season. He's played at least 150 games 9 times, including 2 years where he played in all 162. If that means his numbers will drop because he's fatigued or playing hurt, he's fine with it. Knowing with him in the lineup means this team has a better chance of winning. It's just crazy what he does, man, utility man Tyler Wade says. Last year, he's dealing with all of his elbow stuff and dealing with other injuries. He doesn't come out of the lineup. When you see a guy doing that, you say, if he's doing it, I can play with my injuries. And it's not like he's having just okay years. He's having all-star MVP caliber years every single year. And he's grinding. Everyone across the league knows what he means to the game. There are very few players in this league that have the impact on a city and an organization that he does. He's one of those few players. Really, he's one of the most impressive guys I've ever been around. It's no coincidence that the Padres began to be a power shortly after Machado's arrival as a free agent before the 2019 season. They've made the postseason 3 of the last 5 years, and with a 42-35 record, they're on their way to a 4th consecutive winning season, which has happened only once in their 56-year franchise history. Manny coming here to San Diego is a big reason for us turning things around, says Padres general manager A.J. Preller. It was sending a message to the rest of baseball in terms of a premium impact player in the prime of his career coming here to the Padres. We were selling him on the potential of our vision, what it was going to look like on the field. And now you see a team that's been to the playoffs 3 times in the last 5 years. Next is to see a team led by Manny win the World Series. That's why he plays, honestly. There's nothing more that Machado would love before entering Cooperstown than leading the Padres to a World Series title. Twice they've been to the World Series. Twice. They got knocked off by legendary powerhouses in the 84 Tigers and the 98 Yankees. They had the L.A. Dodgers on the ropes last year, leading 2-1 in the best-of-5 division series. And to this day, the Dodgers will tell you the Padres were easily the best team they played all season. I want to win so bad. That's why we play the game, Machado said. And to win here in a city that's never won before, it would mean everything. It's nothing to do with cementing your legacy or anything like that. I just want to win. When I came here, we had a vision to put this organization on another level. This organization has changed tremendously from day one since I've been here. It's sold out every game, and we consistently win. Machado, who lives on Coronado Island across the bridge from Petco Park, isn't trying to win a popularity contest with the 29 other teams in baseball. He's old school. He would have fit in perfectly with players from the 1960s and 70s like Bob Gibson, Don Drysdale, Pete Rose, and all of those fiery competitors from yesteryear. No one ever accused them of being your friend, but my God, did they ever earn your respect. It's no different from Machado. To fully appreciate him, you got to be with him. If you're in his teammate, he's got your back, and you better have his too. When teammate Fernando Tatis Jr. was hit 3 times in 9 days by the Dodgers, including the last one that required him to get x-rays to make sure his hand wasn't broken, Machado casually offered this warning to anyone who dared listen. Let's just hope his scan comes back negative. The Dodgers got to pray for it to come back negative tomorrow. They need to set a little candle up for Tati tomorrow. Hopefully it comes back negative. That's not a good spot to get hit. I don't care who it is. I don't care who's on the mound. The x-rays were negative, and Tatis played the next day. But Machado was making it quite clear there would be repercussions. He might be one of the most misunderstood players in the game, Padres infielder Jake Cronenworth says. You see him play with that edge, and he's kind of brought that into the rest of the team. You see the way we play. We got guys playing hard, playing every day, and that's what he's brought to this team since he's been here. You look at his career, it's almost the same every year. 150-plus games played, 30 homers. It's just not normal. It's almost the perfect recipe for a guy who's on his way to the Hall of Fame. This guy is on his own path to greatness. Padres manager Mike Schilt, who remembers the impact Pujols had in the Cardinals clubhouse when he came through the organization, sees a lot of similarities with Machado. He's the unofficial captain, the team's heart and soul, and there's not an ounce of phoniness. I think he's probably one of the most misunderstood players in our game, Schilt says. I know the quality of human Manny is. I know Manny's heart. But think what's hard today is the sensitivity, the persecution of just having the ability of being yourself. He's learning to channel all of those things that can be a challenge to be that consistent competitor and still be the core of who you are, which is core of who Manny Machado is, which is very special. It's much more difficult now to have a strong opinion or conviction. I'm not green-lighting doing something inappropriate or to offend someone, but gosh, man, being able to be an alpha, it gets to be more of a challenge for players. Competing hard every day is still okay. You want a commitment by every player to be willing to lay out, and that's what comes with high expectations. I won't apologize for that, and I don't think Manny's going to apologize. Machado should be back on baseball's center stage once again in 3 weeks. He's running away with the All-Star balloting and should be the NL's starting third baseman. It will be a chance, at least momentarily, to bask in his accomplishments, being only the fifth active player to reach 2,000 hits. I haven't really reflected on any of that, Machado says. I still have a lot to accomplish, a lot to look forward to. But you definitely see what's happening in real time. And that's kind of surreal, you know? I just love playing the game. That's all I think about. If I'm not playing baseball, then I don't know what I'd be doing. This is what I was made to do. And now for a quick trip around the base paths. The baseball world lost a giant in the business with the death June 20th of baseball writer Scott Miller, who gave pancreatic cancer everything it could handle during his 20-month-long battle. Miller, who was 62, was a brilliant writer with a heart of gold, loved, admired, and respected by everyone in the baseball community. His sensational book, Skipper, Why Baseball Managers Matter, was just released in May. He was touched when baseball dignitaries like future Hall of Fame manager Dusty Baker, Dodgers manager Dave Roberts, Minnesota Twins greats Torrey Hunter and Jack Jones, and many, many more, reached out to him in the past 2 weeks to express their love. He will be greatly missed, but my best friend in the business will never, ever be forgotten. Former Colorado Rockies manager Bud Black, who turned 68 on June 30th, could be rejoining the Rockies just a month after being dismissed as manager after 8 seasons. Black is a strong candidate to replace Steve Foster, who's leaving his position as the Rockies' director of pitching, to become pitching coach for Texas Tech. Black, a former pitching coach for Mike Socha with the Angels, has let friends know he has no interest in retiring and wants to remain in the game. The Cubs are quietly preparing for the official announcement that they will host the 2027 All-Star Game now that Wrigley Field is getting upgraded security measures. San Diego Padres veteran Gold Glove catcher Martin Maldonado plans to retire after this season, giving him 15 years in the major leagues. He says he wants to take a year off after retirement and then is interested in getting back in the game on a coaching staff. The Yankees and the Giants are keeping a close eye on versatile Pittsburgh Pirates infielder Isaiah Kiner Falefa, who should be available at the trade deadline. In the aftermath of Tampa Bay Rays reliever Hunter Bigg getting struck in the face by a foul ball in the dugout, it's beyond time for the MLB to install netting in front of dugouts. If we're going to protect the fans with netting stretching across the top of the dugouts, why not protect the players? The Arizona Diamondbacks' playoffs hopes continue to take body blows with Cole closers A.J. Puck and Justin Martinez undergoing season-ending elbow surgeries, joining ace Corbin Burns and starters Jordan Montgomery and Tommy Henry. If they're out of the race at the trade deadline, they'll be swarmed with calls seeking starters like Zach Gallen and Merrill Kelly, along with third baseman Eugenio Suarez, first baseman Josh Naylor, and closer Shelby Miller. Rival teams would love to get their hands on Cardinal starters Sonny Gray and Miles Mikolas, but they still have full no-trade clauses, and they have no interest in waiving them. While the Los Angeles Angels certainly have had some nice trade chips like left-hander Tyler Anderson and closer Kenley Jansen and even infielder Luis Reynoso, they still don't plan to sell at the trade deadline unless they suddenly fall apart. It could be a rather dull trade deadline if teams don't start dropping out of the race in the next 5 weeks. Check out the standings. There are only six teams that are out of playoff contention. The White Sox and the Athletics in the American League and the Rockies, the Pirates, the Nationals, and the Marlins in the National League. Ronald Acuña Jr. has played in only 25 games, but the way he's performing, he might well be playing himself right into the All-Star game. He's hitting .396 with a 1.202 OPS, including 8 homers and 16 RBI. If selected, he's volunteering for the Home Run Derby, too. Diamondbacks third baseman Eugenio Suarez is on the verge of being designated for assignment a year ago, but since July 7th of 24 has become the finest power-hitting third baseman in the game. Since that time, he has 46 homers and 134 RBIs, joining the 300-homer club on June 20th, and he should be a coveted free agent after the season. The only players with more homers in this stretch are Aaron Judge and Shohei Ohtani, while no one has more RBI. What a sensational start to a big league career for Milwaukee Brewers rookie Jacob Mizrowski, who opened by throwing 11 no-hit innings in his first two starts. He's the only MLB pitcher in the modern era to have more victories, two, than hits permitted, one, in his first two starts, according to Optostats. Now look who's back, good as ever. Jacob DeGrom is 7-2 with a 2.24 ERA. At 37, he's made 12 consecutive starts, pitching at least 5 innings and allowing 2 or fewer runs. It's the longest streak in the Rangers-Senators history, and the longest by any pitcher 35 or older since 1900, according to Stats. Cardinals third baseman Nolan Arenado is certainly making a case for the Hall of Fame by becoming one of only 7 players in history to hit at least 350 home runs with 10 Gold Glove awards, joining Hall of Famer Mike Schmidt as the only infielder to accomplish the feat. The others, catcher Johnny Bench and outfielders Willie Mays, Ken Griffey Jr., Al Kaline, and Andrew Jones. That cheering sound you heard in the upper Midwest were the Minnesota Twins owners celebrating the news that the Tampa Bay Rays are in advanced talks to sell the team to Jacksonville developer Patrick Zalupski for the reported $1.7 billion. That's billion with a B. If the Rangers are being sold for that amount without a ballpark, the Twins' asking price of $1.7 billion could be an absolute steal. Where's my checkbook? The Phillies, who attempted to lock up DH Kyle Schwarber in spring training, aren't hiding their intentions to re-sign him when he's a free agent. They know how valuable he is in their clubhouse, in addition to being a lethal left-handed bat. If Red Sox first baseman Tristan Casas never got hurt, the feud between Red Sox boss Craig Breslow and Devers is reminiscent of the hostility between former Rockies GM Jeff Bridich and Nolan Arenado when they ultimately traded Arenado to St. Louis. That was an utter disaster. The Rockies have never been the same, and they are on a pace for 125 losses, their third consecutive 100-loss season. They used the savings of the Arenado trade to sign free agent bust Chris Bryant to a 7-year, $182 million contract. After that, Bredish was gone in 2 months, and Arenado is on his way to the Hall of Fame. The Red Sox say they had conversations with the Mariners, Cubs, Padres, Blue Jays, and Atlanta about Devers before dealing him to San Francisco. If the Giants had not agreed to assume the $254.5 million contract remaining, Giants owner Greg Johnson says there would have been no trade. The Giants, ever so quietly, have been acting like, well, a big market team. Why? After assuming Devers' contract, they also shelled out huge deals for Willy Adames, 7 years at $182 million, Matt Chapman, 6 years at $151 million, and Jung-Hoo Lee, 5 years at $104.75 million. That's just the past two off-seasons. Well, there's no better rivalry in baseball these days than the Dodgers and Padres, two franchises that ultimately hate each other. In their four-game series in L.A., there were 8 hit-by-pitches, a bench-clearing incident, 2 managers bumping one another on the field, and 2 managers and a player being suspended. Padres outfielder Fernando Tatis has been hit 5 times by the Dodgers since his comeback from his PED suspension in April of 23, and only 6 other times by the rest of baseball. Fabulous seeing Cubs legend Sammy Sosa back at Wrigley Field on June 20th for the first time in 21 years, the crowd chanting, "Sammy, Sammy, this is my house," Sosa told reporters during his media session. "I always believed it was going to happen. The time is perfect. Now I'm here again, and I will continue to be here. The relationship is tremendous, so hopefully we can continue until the day that I die." Major League Commissioner Rob Manfred was in Las Vegas on June 20th to be part of a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the A's new home on the Vegas Strip in 2028. While the Padres are desperately looking for a left fielder, can you imagine if they still had James Wood, who was sent to the Nationals in the Juan Soto trade? Wood, who's only 22, is hitting .279 with 21 homers and 57 RBI this season. Meanwhile, National shortstop C.J. Abrams, who was also in the trade, should be in the All-Star game, where it's played in his hometown of Atlanta. He leads NL shortstops in OPS at .836 and is second in slugging at .484. Rockies starter Germán Márquez's trade value is starting to climb. He's yielding 3 or fewer runs in 6 of his last 8 starts, with a 3.47 ERA in June. The Houston Astros, who have a comfortable lead in the AL West, are about to get a few reinforcements, with starter Christian Javier, J.P. France, Spencer Arrighetti, and Luis Garcia making their way back from surgeries, and they could be joining the team in the second half. Teams may want to steal a page out of the Angels scouting report on facing Yankee slugger Aaron Judge. He hit .182. 4 for 22, with only 1 extra base hit and 9 strikeouts against them this season. Kudos to Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani for calming everyone down during the heated series against the Padres, waving his team off and telling them to stay in the dugout when he was hit for the second time. Pope Leo XIV got the White Sox fans in a frenzy when he joined in on a White Sox chant while waving to the crowd traveling through Vatican City. While Phillies outfielder Nick Castellanos was benched for a game after snapping at manager Rob Thompson after being pulled out of a game for defensive reasons, he certainly had no problem with the decision a day later. "We're 2 grown men that show up for work every day with the common goal of winning a World Series," Castellanos told reporters. "If everybody just agrees on everything and doesn't speak their mind, there's not going to be passion there. Emotions drive people, especially passionate people. So to think that there's going to be 8 months of consistently being together and not butting heads at all, that probably doesn't happen." No one could have imagined that the Yankees' powerful offense would go AWOL, scoring 7 runs in a 7-game span and losing 6 of them. The last time that happened, would you believe, September 1st through 7th, 1908, according to researcher Katie Sharp. So, just how did Javier Baez of the Tigers celebrate his 10-year anniversary in Major League Baseball? The dude hit 2 home runs. "It's been a long road, lots of ups and downs," Baez told reporters. "In this game, there are a lot of ups and downs, and I've been down many times. and never kept my head down. I kept working, and I'm going to keep working until the last day. Honestly, I'm impressed with the way I'm still doing this. Seattle Mariners catcher Cal Raleigh, who hit his major league leading 31st home run on June 22nd, is now on pace to hit an AL record 66 homers. Next up on his bingo card, he was one stolen base shy of being the fourth catcher in history to hit 30 or more home runs and steal at least 10 bases in a season, joining Hall of Famers Carlton Fisk, who had 37 home runs and 17 steals in 85, Pudge Rodriguez with 35 homers and 25 steals in 1999, and Jimmy Vaux, old-timer, 36 home runs, 10 steals in 1937. And now a story from the NHL champion Panthers, Florida Panthers, that is, hometown paper. Well, maybe not hometown, but from the Palm Beach Post. This is by Hal Habib. For more than half a century, aqua and orange have been the predominant colors South Florida fans could identify with. The Miami Heat broke away from the Miami Dolphins, riding a white-hot theme to NBA championships. But today, South Florida is raining red. The Florida Panthers made it so, defeating the Edmonton Oilers 5-1 in Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final on June 18th for their second consecutive NHL championship. The Oilers won't soon forget Sam Reinhart, who scored the cup-clinching goal in Game 7 last year and scored 4 goals this time. Matthew Tkachuk also added the other goal. As the clock struck 0-0, the goal celebration horn inside Amerant Bank Arena belted an exaggerated blast only marginally louder than the delirious, towel-waving, sold-out crowd. Hockey sticks and rats threw through the air. So did players, hurtling the boards to mob goaltender Sergei Bobrovsky. With it, a season's worth of pressure gave way to a lifetime of dreams that had come true. Rain Red was the team's slogan. That's R-E-I-G-N. It will rain over the NHL for a calendar year, and red, that's R-E-D, will continue to be shouted loudly during Rockets' red glare in the national anthem at home games. Yes, the Stanley Cup is awarded every year at this time, just not like this. The Panthers became only the 10th different franchise in NHL history to repeat as Stanley Cup champions. They also become the third team in South Florida history to win back-to-back titles, joining the Dolphins of the early 70s and the Heat in the early 2010s. The inescapable question now is where the Panthers rank among other championship teams. It's objectively unsolvable, of course. The 72 Dolphins went 17-0, a record that could never be matched in other sports. Yet these Panthers at least placed themselves in that discussion with a postseason performance every bit as dominant, blowing out teams on their own ice. If the Panthers can three-peat, there will be nothing to debate. That's for another day. For this day, for this team, goes one of the most hallowed trophies in sports. It's thanks to a triumvirate at the top of the organization, former owner Vince Viola, general manager Bill Zito, and coach Paul Maurice, extends down to one of the deepest rosters you could assemble, and down to every level of the support staff whom players made sure to credit along the way. The Panthers have become the gold standard of how to run a sports franchise. The core of last year's team returned this year. No matter, the Panthers decided that wasn't good enough, so they pulled off back-to-back deals at the trade deadline to acquire defenseman Seth Jones and forward-slash-instigator-slash-comedian Brad Marchand, both of whom proved invaluable in the postseason. That was a great day to be Maurice, getting tapped on the shoulder by Zito and being told these deals were possible. But Zito explained he was simply operating as his boss wanted. When Viola was told the Panthers needed a new practice facility, "Here you go," Zito said, referring to the Baptist Health Iceplex in Fort Lauderdale. "They know that if the chicken isn't right, that we're going to get a new chicken," Zito said of the players. "It sort of transcends all that we do. It sounds silly, but it's true and it's real." So too is Maurice's approach, which shouldn't add up, but does. His defense-first philosophy allows the Panthers to use the regular season the way a college student uses the term to prepare for the final exam. How, then, to explain that 9 players on this defensive team had 15 more points in the postseason, a mark surpassed by exactly 0 teams in league history? Maurice admitted that after a rare bad loss, he'd start team meetings with 5 minutes of cursing, but end them with hugs all around. His modesty is almost to a fault. I've had a chance to be here to observe them and learn from them, Maurice said on the eve of Game 1. The way they treat each other is different from what I've experienced. But not just in life, not just in hockey. It's been an honor to kind of be in that room and watch the way they treat each other. If you're building a Mount Rushmore of coaches of our pro teams, you can start with Don Shula, then add the Heat's Eric Spoelstra. Just don't forget Maurice. Panthers culture is a phrase that deserves to become a thing. A bit of an observer here is how Maurice described himself. It's a bit of a season ticket holder that I am. Kachuk isn't buying it, nor should anyone else. His ability to get us to run through a wall each and every game is a big gift, Kachuk said. Super lucky to have him. Prophetic, too. Kachuk may have added about his coach. Before and even during the final seasons, Maurice predicted the highest level of hockey would be on display. In the Oilers, the Panthers faced the best player on the planet and a deserved cup winner in Connor McDavid, plus one of the best in Leon Draisaitl. The Panthers also were facing an Oilers team more complete than the one they beat in 7 games to win the big prize last year. Maurice's prediction of no-lull hockey was on the money. These finals had action early. 3 games began with goals in the first 2.5 minutes, and late. 3 of the first 4 games went into overtime. The 2 latest game-tying goals in history were scored as regulation expired. It's 3,023 and a tenth miles from Amerant Bank Arena to Rogers Place in Edmonton. Yet, despite a brutal travel schedule, both teams found success at home and on the road. This Panthers postseason provided all of that. Laughs, too. When Marchand was caught on camera licking a spoon during intermission, he said he'd been enjoying a blizzard from Dairy Queen. I know he said it, Maurice said. I'm just not sure that makes it a fact. Marchand eventually fessed up. It was just hockey. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman laughed off complaints that maybe the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Panthers have dominated the Stanley Cup final lately because of a lack of state income tax, an accusation that conveniently overlooks all the years neither team made noise. Perhaps the Panthers could send a crying towel, we suggest a red one, to TNT analyst Paul Bissonnette, who whined about the tax inequality after unprofessionally wearing Maple Leafs attire on air during the Florida-Toronto series. Never mind that he never played for the Leafs. Better to get back to discussing the many things that went right, including the leadership of humble captain Alexander Barkov, whom many credit with setting the tone. Marchand had some history with the Panthers dating to his time as Boston's captain. Yet it wasn't long until teammates were playfully firing rats at him to celebrate victories. Forward Thomas Nosek committed a costly penalty that set up Draisaitl's overtime winner in Game 1 that could have set the tone for the series. What followed? Well, we just make sure he doesn't eat alone tonight, Maurice said. He's got lots of people sitting at his table and reminding him how good he's been. So too, Barkov, who became the first player in NHL history to sweep both the Selke Trophy for best defensive forward and the King Clancy leadership, community service, in 1 season. As for the other players without whom the Panthers wouldn't be where they are, take your pick. Conn Smythe winner Sam Bennett, of course, Reinhardt, Gustav Forsling, Aaron Ekblad, Nate Schmidt, Carter Verhaeghe, Bob. How much time you got? This season, all of them earned a permanent place in South Florida sports history. The Panthers didn't just win the Stanley Cup. They won Game 6. They became a dynasty. They painted the town red. And that concludes our reading of the sports news for this week. I thank you for your listening. Once again, this is Kent Batty, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a good day. Miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org by left-clicking on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.